Jacksonville's next mayor and who will get elected to some other offices. We'll take a closer look right now. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening this morning. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, some insights into this city's upcoming unitary election. If you don't know what a unitary election is, we'll explain that too. Give us a call right now at 549-2937 as we talk politics on the show this morning. Also coming up this hour, enriching lives through food with the Jack's Cooking Studio. That's in our movable feast. Then later in the hour, NPR's own Al Letson has written a special play. It's about bullying, and your kids should see it. We'll tell you how. All of that coming up this morning. But first this hour, Jacksonville voters won't be heading to the polls again until March 19th, but the race for mayor is already heating up. Not only are voters choosing a city leader, they're also voting in a number of other elections. Now, this is a unitary election, so your partisan affiliation is not so important here. How does all this work exactly? Why do we have an election in March anyway? We've got insights right now from two experts as we welcome John Delaney, former mayor of Jacksonville and former president of UNF. He's a current shareholder at Rogers Towers and a principal with the Fiorentino Group. John Delaney, always a pleasure. Good morning.
Good to be back with you. Thanks.
Good to have you on the show. Also with us, Daniel Cronrath, Florida State College at Jacksonville. He's a political science professor there. Hey, Daniel, good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
And we are talking about the March unitary election this morning. If you are a Jacksonville voter and you have questions and comments, we want your calls. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page as well. Okay, let's begin with the former mayor, John Delaney. We've got a mayor's race in the city now. Incumbent Mayor Lenny Curry facing a high-profile challenger, Jacksonville at-large City Council Rep Anna Brochet. How do you see this race shaking out?
Well, I'll start with this. Out of the last eight mayors, four of them didn't serve a second term. And Jacksonville can have a habit of eating its mayors. Now, in each of those cases, there was contributing factors to why they were vulnerable. Three were defeated, one didn't run again. And so that can happen. Secondly, of those that ran for office, it was five, they all lost their next election. And so you can kind of get where you eat your young in this town. But what you really need, I think, to be able to defeat an incumbent mayor is you need some kind of a scandal or a hiccup or a wedge issue. You need high name recognition and or money. Name recognition you can buy if you have the money. But money's really a key anymore in the modern races. It takes billions of dollars to get elected mayor in Jacksonville. Because the city and county are consolidated. We don't have, like Dade County has, 33 or 34 little municipalities, each with their own mayor.
Right. You were unopposed, I think, when you sought re-election.
Yeah, apparently the only mayor in Jacksonville's history since the 1830s that didn't have an opponent, which I've run with an opponent and without's a lot better.
A lot better, sure. It's 549-2937 to join us. Okay, so Daniel Cronrath, as former Mayor Delaney just pointed out, when you look at this contest between Curry and Brochet, certainly Mayor Curry has strong name recognition. He's got a record to run on. He's got $3 million in the bank. So he's going to run on those attributes. What are his strengths and what are his weaknesses? And what are the strengths and weaknesses of his most high-profile opponent, Anna Brochet?
Yeah, I think as Mayor Delaney pointed out, the first advantage he has is he does have a war chest. You know, $3 million in the bank with his political committee. He does have name recognition, not just from the fact that he has cash, but he's also a sitting mayor. And there's a lot of name recognition that comes with the fact that he's currently holding the office. He gets to function symbolically as mayor, but he's also the mayor of a strong mayor system, which unlike weak mayor systems in which he's not basically running the administrative aspects of government, he is. A lot of the things which have taken place in the last 3.5 years are directly attributed to him, good or bad. I think that in terms of vulnerability, that's going to be the challenge for Anna Brochet in this race. Is she has to give the voters of Jacksonville a compelling reason for a change. And whether she can do that, I think that at the end of the day, she will have the money. I think that's one of the things in the fall and leading up into this race, which has kind of been a misnomer, if you will, is I think that the resources will come to her, particularly when you only have 2 months to spend the resources. I think that she will be able to be well-resourced approaching March. But what is going to be her vision for the city? What reason will she give the electorate of Jacksonville to say, you know what, we've had enough of Mayor Curry? As John said previously, you know, typically there's going to have to be, whether it's a scandal, whether there's something which is going to give the voters, will it be JEA, for example? Will that be the issue that she's able to pivot on? Will it be crime? That's something that she's already been talking about. We don't know. We're going to have to see how that plays out.
And let us know who'll get your vote in the March elections. Mayor Curry, a challenger such as Anna Brochet. There are others on the ballot, too. And what are your questions about some of the other races on the ballot? It's 549-2937. Give us a call or send us a tweet. Okay, so public safety. Mayor Curry, John Delaney, was able to topple Alvin Brown, former mayor, on that issue, basically saying Alvin Brown hasn't kept the city safe. Now we see Anna Brochet lobbying the same accusation at Lenny Curry. This is a city that's been plagued with high rates of gun violence, homicide for so many years. It's been a challenge to whoever's held the office. Can Brochet successfully pin that on Curry the way Curry was able to on Brown? And what about this JEA issue, this ongoing speculation that the mayor and his team were behind efforts to privatize the utility? Will voters care about that or not?
Yeah, go with the crime issue first. I think it's a little bit different. What Mayor Curry claimed on the incumbent Mayor Brown was that he was sort of denying that there was a problem, wasn't putting the resources into hiring police officers, and you had a sheriff mightily complaining about not being able to put people on the street. A lot of that, frankly, was the lingering effects of the massive recession from 08. It just crippled Mayor Brown's ability to hire or to spend money on some of these issues. And of those three mayors that lost re-election, three of the four that did not serve a second term, they all were struggling with a recession. And that has a big impact on your ability to really kind of address these issues. And I'm horrible now with the set. Your second question was on?
On JEA.
Yeah, on the JEA. I think the mayor probably would concede that was awkwardly handled. And there are, as Tom Pettway said, who is the chair of the JEA and kind of the founder of the Jaguars, he says this is a mature asset. It's time to sell it. It's at its peak. You know, utility usage is going down in this country despite population growth. I'm not sure I'm there necessarily.
But why not?
I just think having public ownership of it over time is probably healthier. I'm not in concrete on that, but that's somebody with not a whole lot of information on what those upsides would be. But I think that utility is always going to be worth more in a year than it is last year. And but in any event, I don't see that as a political issue necessarily. I do think the crime one may well be. What's a little interesting to me is I was a former chief assistant state attorney. The murder rate was almost double what it was back when the crack cocaine epidemic took effect. I think the problem now is that it appears, according to the sheriff and the state attorney, be largely gang-related, and you've got just innocent kids getting caught up in the crossfire. And I do think a mayor, you know, and I think, you know, the mayor and the city council realize this, that crime is not just up to the sheriff and the state attorney. It's really overall about prevention. It's about the environment. It's about schools. It's about libraries, about after-school programming, those kinds of things.
We had a whole initiative some years ago with a previous mayoral administration, the Payton administration, the Jacksonville Journey, which tried to take that comprehensive, holistic approach to crime. That, as you pointed out, was victim to a recession. It lost a lot of funding in the financial crisis. Now we're hearing the city say, oh, we need to start a new task force on crime, which sounds like it's going to be somewhat like what was already tried before. So, Daniel Cronrath, how important do you think this issue is to the voters right now? What's the issue that's going to drive this election?
Well, I think crime is definitely probably going to be the biggest issue. I think that, you know, some other things that Brochet has outlined in terms of accountability and transparency in government. You know, you hear rumors and whispers of City Hall about the culture being very toxic and about the mayor and his staff not always playing nice and being kind of bullyish in terms of their politics. And that all may well be the case. But the question becomes is how does that translate to the average voter? What does the average voter care about the culture of City Hall if their trash is being picked up and if services are being performed, if the economy is good? So it's going to be really taking that aspect of her campaign and trying to translate that into how the everyday person is going to feel about it.
And let me ask you both this as well. This is a unitary election. We've gotten a lot of calls from people asking about this. They don't necessarily understand it. Can you explain a little bit about the history of this, why we vote in March, and also why it's a top vote-getter election? What that means basically is you can vote for any candidate you want. It doesn't matter what your party affiliation is. If you're a Republican, you can vote for a Democrat in races that are on the ballot, or vice versa. So why do we have it this way?
It changes the geometry of an election. It's often referred to as a jungle primary, where all the candidates of all parties run together. And unless one gets 50% in the initial jungle primary, then you go to a runoff between the top two vote getters. In Jacksonville's case, it's pretty much a Republican versus a Democrat. In this case, it doesn't look like that's going to happen, because it looks like the two top candidates, which are both Republicans, are probably going to have the money to drive that kind of a thing. And we'll see where that goes from there. But kind of following up on Daniel's point, I think the issue is, what's the wedge issue? You know, what is the scandal, the vulnerability? You mentioned crime, Melissa. I was in a meeting with the sheriff. I don't think he'd mind me quoting him on this, where he said, I can't hire any more police officers. I am maxed out in terms of, he says, I cannot complain about the budget that I've gotten from the mayor. And I'll be honest with you, that's the first sheriff I've ever heard say that. Mm-hmm. And I've been around the courthouse and city hall since the 1980s. So, something still needs to change. You know, we've got neighborhoods that are hearing gunshots every single night. And I don't remember hearing that before. And I don't know, again, what that solution is going to be. But as you said, Mayor Payton did that Jacksonville journey, and it did drive crime down.
It did.
There's no question of that. Now, he took about 5% of the budget to put into it,
which
is a phenomenal commitment. And we'll see what happens next with the city council task force.
Yeah. Right. So John Delaney just mentioned it's a Republican versus Democratic race. In a sense, it is, because although we have two prominent Republicans vying for this office, Anna Brochet's strategy increasingly seems to be to try to draw as many Democratic votes as she can. As I'm looking at Twitter this morning, she apparently spoke to a Democratic group last night, and there are a lot of photos of that appearing on social media this morning. There's no Democrat running. And what does that say about the state of the local Democratic Party in a county that went blue in November, Daniel? This county, Duval, went for Andrew Gillum in the governor's race. And yet at the same time, there's no one on the Democratic side trying to challenge Mayor Curry.
Sure.
So let's talk about that, too.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of criticism recently on the local Democratic Party for their inability to field a candidate. But in reality, you have to look at the field and say, OK, who would it be? You know, part of this isn't just an immediate issue. It's more of a lasting, what kind of candidates has the local Democratic Party been grooming? And really, they're kind of non-existent, Melissa. But taking a quick step back to the Jacksonville journey, I remember the words of Sheriff
Rutherford. Andrew, can I pause you on that one, though? Because I think I disagree a little bit with your statement. I think there's plenty of local Democrats that would be terrific candidates.
Then why didn't they run?
Well, a lot's going to be money. And that will go back to the Democratic Party, as it is not particularly well organized locally or statewide to be able to pump money into these races, although it did behind Alvin Brown. But Audrey Gibson is a phenomenal candidate, in my opinion. And Mia Jones almost won her election against Jim Overton, who's a longtime elected official. I think Mia Jones would be a tremendous candidate. Nat Glover would have been a great candidate. Now, he's in his 70s, and I think I don't see him ever running again. But no, you're heading to another point, but I think there's local candidates that would have been viable. The problem will be, is there Democratic money to be able to get behind those candidates?
I hear what you're saying, but I mean, I would tend to also go back to the fact that in a county that Andrew Gillum carried by 4 points in the general election, Mia Jones lost. You know, there were other Democrats.
By a few thousand votes,
votes. I mean, she still lost, you know, with as attractive and as appealing as a candidate as Tracy Paulson was, for example. She still lost in that seat in a local race. So I think
it's pretty gerrymandered district, though.
Yeah, it's a pretty gerrymandered district.
But that gets into the problems on the ground for Democrats, not just in Jacksonville, but in Florida. Gerrymandering is still a big issue in this state, as it is in most states. Most of the money is on the Republican side. It makes it more difficult for Democrats to win, whether it's a citywide election or a statewide election.
Well, that's gerrymandered, though. I mean, the gerrymander is going to be at the district. Countywide's a different deal. That's where it's wide open. And Tracy Paulson, I'm glad she's another candidate that I think was
one factor feeds the other. You know, if a state has been gerrymandered for decades, then that creates a spiraling effect where less and less money keeps flowing to the party that has structural disadvantages. One thing feeds the other.
Yeah. Let's go back to your initial point, moving away from that. It is when you talk about the Roche campaign, she clearly has to build some sort of Democratic coalition. And frankly, she has to build a Democratic coalition in a city where there are prominent Democrats supporting this mayor. Members of city council right now who benefit from their relationship with Mayor Curry, who are not going to be outspoken for a Roche campaign. So it's going to be, she definitely has to, you know, get that kind of coalition from the other party. Again, in a race where we, as you said, we have no, it's amazing. Andrew Gillum wins the city by 4 points and we have no prominent Democrat running for mayor.
Let's go to your calls now about the March elections in Jacksonville. They're March 19th. It's a unitary election. Who will get your vote? What are your questions? It's 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. As they were talking, other questions came up, of course, but my main question that I was calling about is I was wondering how much do you think voters will care about transparency? I worry about corporate welfare, and whenever anybody says, what is your major concern, and they say jobs, I think that what they mean is the taxpayers are going to start giving money to for-profit industries, and a lot of the transparency issues with Curry was we're wondering what kind of backroom deals he's making without letting the voting population know about it. And one of the things in particular, you might know more about this, was that Alvin Brown gave some deals, some global ministries to buy Eureka Gardens, and then global ministries did not do the repairs, and it seemed like it came back to bite us. And I was reading an article, just to refresh my memory, the other day at the Florida Times Union about a lot of that deal was not as transparent to the population and could have been maybe open to more criticism and more restrictions could have been put on that deal rather than giving them so many incentives to buy Eureka Gardens without guarantees of improvements.
Okay. It sounds like you're saying whoever's in office, you see a long-running pattern of local government not always operating in a transparent way, Susan, it sounds like. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair.
Okay, sure. And thanks for that. You know, and this recent task force on open government concluded much the same. So certainly you can see Anna Broche trying to make hay out of that. Will that gain traction with the voters?
It hasn't in the past. Again, it goes to, or is there a scandalous sort of a thing? Eureka Garden was murky. There's no question of that, where that money came from. That all was after the fact, aha kind of a thing. I agree with the caller on the corporate welfare stuff, although that tends to be more in Washington and Tallahassee. Now, if you're talking about economic incentives to try to get a business to expand or locate here, I think that's a different ballgame. And in that case, that goes through typically, if it's downtown, the Downtown Investment Authority, and the city council's got to vote on it, so there's a shot for it. Some of it, I'm really afraid, is just how local media has been so devastated by the economy, it's just hard to get coverage of some of these things and have enough reporters to be on top of them.
That's absolutely right. We're all doing the best we can with our resources. Daniel Cronrath, what are your thoughts about all this?
I mean, I think that right now in Jacksonville, you have some intrepid reporting taking place from your colleagues, Melissa, who are in underfunded newsrooms that have literally been gutted, and they're still out there and they're still fighting the good fight, trying to deliver real news, not fake news, I may add, you know, to the people who live here in Jacksonville. I think relative to the caller's point about transparency, I hate to repeat a point, but if there are accountability and transparency issues in City Hall, and if they are real things that we should be concerned about, how do they touch the lives of voters? That's really going to come. I mean, you can talk about a bullyish culture. You can talk about lack of transparency. You can tell the story about how the mayor basically came in and he took everyone who was on volunteer commissions and he sacked them for his own appointments. But again, that may sound appalling, or maybe folks don't like that. But how does it impact our lives? In an election where you're probably going to have, what, a 30, 35, 40% turnout at best, you know, how is that going to translate to the average
and
voter?
Let's talk about that for a minute. Why don't we have this election in a cycle when more people are coming to the polls? Why are we voting in March? We just got a bunch of voters out to the polls in November, which is a huge effort. Now voters are being asked to come out again.
Yeah, I may be one of the few lone wolves in the woods on that. I think the city's far better to have the election off here and in the spring. We would get caught up in the U.S. Senate race. We would get caught up in the governor's race. We'd get caught up in the state house, Senate, congressional races, the school board. And I think having the ability to focus on a mayor's race, a sheriff's race, the constitutional officers and the city council, where the focus can be on those, I think is far better than all of the noise in the even year elections. And I hope that never changes. And I've resisted it whenever it's came up before when I was in City Hall.
Two lone wolves on that. I happen to
you
agree. I agree with John. I think that putting.
But it sounds like when you call yourselves lone wolves, you feel you're in the minority. I guess a lot of people aren't as happy.
Well, yeah, I think that there's a lot of public sentiment would just be, why don't we have all these elections put together? Well, you know, if you want to increase turnout and you want to increase participation in voting for our mayor, then you should. You know, book that with larger races. I think it's unfortunate. I agree with John on this. I think that so many of the issues that impact our lives on our daily basis take place at the local level, our parks, our libraries, our schools, our law enforcement, our first responders. You know, these are all things which in my mind merit a separate election. Now, we can all work to try to drive up turnout, which is something that we should all, whether you're Republican or Democrat or whomever, you know, participating in our democracy and getting folks to come out and instilling in them the importance. But I too favor the idea of having a separate election for these offices. They're too important to bundle in with other elections.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking right now with Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ and John Delaney, former mayor, UNF president, now principal with the Fiorentino Group, about the upcoming March elections in Jacksonville. You'll be asked to go to the polls again in a couple of months. On March 19th, Mayor Curry's on the ballot. He has challengers. Sheriff Mike Williams is on the ballot. City council races are up for grabs. The tax collector's race, other races. What are your questions? What are your comments? It's 549-2937. Give us a call right now. Jason is in San Marco. Hi, Jason. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. My thought is I was thinking the other day that, you know, the local Democrats have they have a lack of leadership is what I'm perceiving. And I blogged about this. What would be the possibilities of the local Democrats recruiting someone like a Gwen Graham to move here, take up residence in Duval County, and start becoming a force and see if she could garner enough support to maybe challenge the mayor, whoever it may be, in the immediate future. And it might be a better stepping stone for her into maybe the future governorship. I would love to hear what your panelists think about that idea.
Too late. Yeah, it's too late. You have to have a residency established and qualifying's over right now. So too late to get in.
Yeah, I think the other question would be is, well, there may be some, you know, may seem logical to some degree. I mean, would she just be looking as an opportunistic candidate moving here to specifically run for office in a city that she's never called home, she's never lived in?
It sounds like, though, from his tone, he's wishing a more prominent Democrat would come in and boost up the local party. At the same time, I mean, let's talk about the fact that both parties groom talent. They try to grow people, get them in the pipeline, start them in smaller races, move them up the chain. That's typically how it's done. How do you rate the emerging talent of these two parties in this city and what could be done better so that people love to complain about poor leadership. What are the parties doing to recruit really good people to run and win?
I mean, I would say firstly, I mean, I think that the Mayor Curry, in terms of being a politician, deserves a lot of credit. You're really looking, when you analyze what's going on in Jacksonville right now, he has built a 21st century political machine in our city using modern tools such as fundraising, political committees. I remember on your media roundtable a few weeks ago, somebody had asked the question, you know, why does a mayor need a $3 million standing political committee? If I'm Mayor Curry, I'm asking the question, why not? I'm capable of doing it. I'm capable of advancing my message. It's completely within the rules. And so I think relative to that, I think that the Republicans are far stronger locally than the Democrats. But to John's point, I mean, there are prominent Democrats out there. Audra Gibson is a very, very respected political figure who's in the prime of her political career. But down from that, who are they grooming? You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. And let me get your thoughts about what he just said, John, about the mayor's what's being called a political machine. City Hall today in Jacksonville is very different from when you were mayor. You didn't have a PAC. You didn't have accusations of being surrounded by a machine, which has sort of dogged this mayor's steps, even though, as Daniel pointed out, it's been effective for him politically. So as you watch this now as a guy who's out of politics, what are your thoughts about how this is being done today?
Well, it seems to be the coin of the realm. And Governor Scott did the same thing. You know, he had a kind of an ongoing perpetual campaign where he raised a lot of money and ran ads in the middle of his term to advance his agenda. And I think Daniel worded it right. Why not? You know, I mean, if the laws allow you to do that, and if people are willing to contribute money for you to be able to keep driving that message, that's probably the way that's going to go. And it's going to be, I think, kind of following up on Daniel again, it's going to be a problem for the local Democratic Party in that they ought to be doing the same thing and ought to be, you know, critiquing and attacking and being the loyal opposition on some of these things. You know, when you've had the ability or the chance, I should say, of, say, the Democrats on city council to elect a Democrat as a city council president, they bolted. And the four African-American, I think it was all four African-American city council members, the Democratic bloc, District 7, 8, 9, and 10, could have voted for John Crescenbeny to become council president and did not, and ended up voting for a Republican. Now, I've long said that, quoting former New York Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, there's no Democratic-Republican way to pick up garbage. And in the old days, lack of mm-hmm. a better phrase, mm-hmm. there was a lot more bipartisanship. The idea was that we really didn't have, you know, the flashpoint issues as abortion and these kinds of things didn't really apply at the local level. And so you tried to work to get some comedy between the votes. You just wanted 10 votes to be able to get your agenda through. But it's a little different day right now. We'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah. Let's go to a few more calls about this. And then I want to ask former Mayor Delaney your thoughts about the demolition of the old city hall down the street. That's going down any day now. And as I was driving by it yesterday, I noticed there'd been more progress. So for people that have never been inside that building, I thought it might be fun to hear some reminiscence about it. So I think we have time to do that. It's 549-2937. If you could put Linda in the queue. Linda is in Deerwood. Hi, Linda. Hi, Linda. You're on the air. Go ahead, Linda.
Yes. I just wanted to say, you know, I understand that we have gentlemen that are part of political establishments, but if the goal of democracy is to have more of the electors participate, then I just don't understand. Yes, the mayor has a PAC. He can deliver the message, but wouldn't that be better if he could deliver the message actually out in the neighborhoods, where I could see the mayor, where I could go to something and not have somebody show me an ad or show me a slick presentation? I think he's doing what he can within the law, but who says that's the right thing to do for Jacksonville?
Okay.
Because I don't think that I think he's doing it for post-Jacksonville purposes and not to be the mayor of the city. Thanks.
Okay. I guess thinking Mayor Curry has higher political aspirations. One thing I will say, just to be fair to all of the candidates, whether it's Curry or anybody else, I know that this is the season where we will see ads on TV, but we'll also see a lot of door knocking and people going door to door in neighborhoods trying to kind of make the case to voters. I think that is underway. So, Linda, I hope that the candidates come through your neighborhood.
Yeah. And let me just say to Linda, I agree with what you're saying and I hear what you're saying. And I think when we discuss the political acumen of this mayor, I don't think that or any mayor, I don't think that anyone is suggesting that that's a preferred political culture. I think that you have basically within the last decade in the United States watched the disappearance of policy conversations during campaigns. I mean, it used to be, I remember Rick Mulvaney, who had run for mayor here in town, talked about his 37 or his 39 point plan. I forget how many points, but it was detailed. And it was something like that was really the turning point with folks. Despite the fact that we may want that kind of policy detail, I mean, most folks demonstrate that they don't. They respond to different things and they
build the wall.
Yeah. And
hope, you know, and change.
Yeah. And I mean, right. I hate to go to the presidential level on this, but even when you go to the center or the presidential level or the mayor level, it used to be that folks had to come out and they had to have detailed plans and they had to have policy papers and position papers. And this is where we want to go. Nobody does that anymore because we've really turned into just kind of the world of advertising and marketing have really dominated our politics and our political campaign.
Sad but true. Okay.
Yeah, I think you know, I often say politicians move in symbols. And the symbol is, to use the one you just quoted, build the wall. That became a catchphrase that everybody has a big agenda wrapped around what that means and what that involves. And I do think that that's a bit of a shame. I know when I was mayor, we did a town meeting every month and promoted it and advertised it. And the idea was to kind of let the public know, hey, if you want a vent, you got a problem, you know, we're accessible. And it is less relevant nowadays. I don't know if voters care less about it. You know, the newspaper circulation has really, really dropped. People are getting news from alternative sources. I still think this program really shapes a lot of dialogue, Melissa. I've told you that for years.
We try. Thanks.
Well, I think it really does. I mean, this is, you know, people, hey, I'm Melissa Ross yesterday, such and such said this, this, and this. And I think this kind of a format, I think, is very healthy for democracy. But, you know, is I can't even remember who quoted it, you get the democracy you deserve. And so, yeah. Linda, we need to say what we want, and I think we need to do it en masse and what we want to hear and what we want to see.
Yeah. Absolutely. And let me also make a plug for our website, where our digital editor, Bill Bortsfield, is putting up a whole breakout about the March elections. And you can learn about all of the candidates. That's coming up online at wjctnews.org. Check it out before you vote. Okay. Last but not least, down the street from us, where we sit here at WJCT Studios, some buildings are coming down, I believe this weekend, the old Duval County Courthouse and the old City Hall Annex. And so, John Delaney, share your thoughts about those buildings as they're about to see their last.
Yeah, I spent almost two decades in each of them, because I was in the courthouse and then in the what we now call the old City Hall. With regards to Old City Hall, I mean, there's you tend to think of the votes, the big things that came through, say the vote for the Jaguars in 1993. The building itself, I'm kind of a good riddance. I mean, it was not a well designed building, very, very small floor plates. Government office buildings have no place on the waterfront. Yeah. The reason they went there is because they were old rotten wooden wharfs, rat infested, and that was really kind of a 1950s version of urban development. And so I view it as progress. I'm kind of glad to see them gone. And wished we'd been able to get rid of them sooner, and looking forward to see what goes up to replace them.
Yeah, definitely so. And let me just also tell a quick little story. A colleague of mine across the street, Ann Schindler at First Coast News, she had her eye on those letters on that building, City Hall Annex. And they had taken down the letters that spelled out City and Hall, but for some reason, Annex stayed up for a long time. Well, somebody went over and took those letters down and gave them to her. So she now has Ann spelled out. I don't know where she put these huge metal letters that were on a government building, but they're now hers. So kudos to you, Ann Schindler. You got away with it. So Daniel Cronrad.
Until today.
Yeah. I think they put video of it on online, so I think the secret's out.
But what will she do with the letters is the question.
I know.
Melissa.
And
what?
The X.
Yes. Yeah.
So Daniel Cronrad of FSCJ and John Delaney of the Fiorentina Group, a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us this morning.
Thanks,
great
Melissa.
To be with you. Thanks
Thank
again.
You.
And up next, it's our movable feast. If you need to learn how to cook and you don't know where to start, we'll tell you about the Jack's Cooking Studio next here on First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going well, the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going well, the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze. And skipping over the ocean like a stone. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes.
High Tide Burrito Company wishes its customers a safe and healthy new year. If your New Year's resolutions include better food choices, High Tide offers fresh, made-from-scratch Mexican food that won't weigh you down. Lunch and catering menus at HighTideBurrito.com.
The Pontevedra Concert Hall presents stand-up comedian Robert Klein on Sunday, January 20th. For nearly 40 years, Klein's observational comedy has won over crowds and landed him roles on Broadway, film, and television. Tickets for Robert Klein at Ticketmaster.com.
First Coast teachers join WJCT and ViStar Credit Union for the 6th Annual Teach Conference, a day to engage, empower, and inspire. Featured keynote speakers are Wes Moore and Hamish Brewer. Educators will present breakout sessions and share best practices on topics such as equity, classroom management, and technology. Attendees will enjoy breakfast, lunch, a swag bag, and so much more on Saturday, March 2nd at the Hyatt Hotel. Find more information at wjct.org/teach.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. If you've always wanted to learn how to cook but just didn't know where to start, here's your answer. In today's Movable Feast, our look at culinary trends all around the town, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance speaks to Terry DeVlantes of Jack's Cooking Studio about her mission to enrich lives through food.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami.
So what is the Jack's Cooking Studio?
I'm opening a cooking studio to teach adult children and teens and people with chronic illnesses how to cook, get people back in their kitchens, and then also a little bit about nutrition information, because a lot of the things that we're eating today are not as healthy as maybe they should be. We have 4 different instructional kitchens in our cooking studio.
And where is it, actually, in Jacksonville?
It is on Beach Boulevard between Hodges and San Pablo. It's an 1,800-square-foot kitchen, and our concept is to get everyone as much hands-on experience as possible, because that's how you develop culinary confidence.
So instead of some of the cooking schools where you may sit theater-style and be an audience, you prefer the hands-on, people learning how to use knives and actually prepare the food themselves.
We do. It's a lot of fun to get there and get your hands dirty, involved in the food preparation as you're watching the chef at his area, and he will demo to the crowd how to cook the meal, and then he'll come by and visit each station. As I said, we have 4 different cooking stations, so we'll divide the guests up into small groups of 4 or 5.
Oh, that's great. That's very personal.
And then you'll develop more confidence in your cooking abilities the more you do it. I come from a background in higher education and nursing.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, what was it that prompted you to open this at this point in your career?
For the past close to 20 years, I've been developing new academic programs in higher education, but my background is as a registered coronary care nurse, so I thought of how I could combine those two and try to figure out how to make an impact on the health of our Northeast Florida residents. So our goal is to not only teach people how to cook, because when women started entering the workforce years ago, which is a good thing, they are traditionally the ones, even to this day, that are responsible for cooking. And they don't have time in their day between working a full-time job and raising children to come home and cook a meal. When women entered the workforce, they had to lose the time of coming home and cooking meals. But they're losing that family time of sitting down at a family
yes.
meal. And they're also losing the opportunity to teach their children the important life skill of cooking.
So what are some of the classes that you're offering?
We offer a variety of adult classes that are focused on international foods, such as Aegean food, Italian, French cooking, just farm-to-table types of meals. We also offer a fundamentals of cooking series, so that if you need to learn how to cook or you just need a refresher in that, it will be a total of 6 classes.
That's
3
great.
Hours
That's like Cooking 101.
Cooking 101.
Yes. Well, I know that we here at the Movable Feast are very excited that you've decided to do this new venture of Jack's Cooking Studio, and I think I'm going to be seeing you very soon.
Well, we look forward to that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining
me.
Us on Movable Feast.
Thank you.
Everybody eats when they come to mind.
And in a moment, fighting bullying through a play. We'll explain next. Welcome back. Well, Babs Lab is presenting a special performance of the critically acclaimed anti-bullying play Chalk. Now, it was written by NPR's own Reveal host, Al Letson, and it's being performed for local students. This is so timely because a new study shows bullying is on the rise in our nation's schools. Barbara Colicello is producer and director of Babs Lab, and she's here now with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So good to see you, and always happy to spotlight what you're doing. Let's talk about the fact that a new study out of Virginia finds that since the 2016 presidential election, teachers around the country say they're seeing increased name-calling and bullying in their classrooms. Pretty alarming.
And I'm not surprised, because that is a perfect environment for that sort of thing to happen. And of course it's happening because what's happening in the adult world, what's happening on social media, the way people write their comments, you can hear that they're being verbally abusive.
Yeah.
And the kids pick up on it.
It's terrible. So this play was written in response to that. Tell us about Chalk.
Well, Al Letson wrote the play in about 2005 when the Baltimore School of the Arts commissioned him to write a play for their senior ensemble. And he wanted to do something meaningful and obviously came up with the idea of doing a play that would bring what happens to kids in middle school, high school, and how they're subjected to one another's verbal abuse. And since then, we've done a couple of productions of it, and I've always said to Al, I really want to do the full production again. It's my way of giving back to the community. It's the way I know how to reach this problem.
You've also got a community outreach program component to this.
Absolutely.
There's a field trip to the Florida Theater for kids to see this free of charge.
Absolutely. So what happened is I approached the Florida Theater because I thought how wonderful if this play could be in that environment. They love the idea of doing the production and working with me, and we applied for a PNC Arts Alive grant. Mm-hmm. And we were very excited that we were awarded a $15,000 grant. And so part of that grant was the idea of bringing in Title I schools free of charge, pay for the buses, and get them in the seats, as well as other community members and other schools.
We're going to keep talking about this. It's a way to teach kids about bullying and how to stop it in their schools, how you can get your child to see a free performance of Chalk as well at the Florida Theater. Back in a moment. Keep listening.
For just 1 hour, if we could find a way to get inside each other's minds, if you could see you through my eyes and study your ego, I believe you'd be surprised to see that you've been blind. Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Yeah. And before you abuse, criticize and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes.
High Tide Burrito Company wishes its customers a safe and healthy new year. If your New Year's resolutions include better food choices, High Tide offers fresh, made-from-scratch Mexican food that won't weigh you down. Lunch and catering menus at HighTideBurrito.com.
The Ponte Vedra Concert Hall presents stand-up comedian Robert Klein on Sunday, January 20th. For nearly 40 years, Klein's observational comedy has won over crowds and landed him roles on Broadway, film, and television. Tickets for Robert Klein at Ticketmaster.com.
Who is the United States leaving on the battlefield in Syria?
The Kurdish militias have been instrumental in defeating ISIS. Their biggest victory came in October 2017 when they captured the northern city of Raqqa.
A look at the fate of the Kurdish fighters on the front lines against ISIS. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Junk bonds haven't exactly been selling like hotcakes of late. Investors have, if you will, cut them from their corporate diets.
It was the first month since 2008 where there were no high-yield issuance in the market, and that's very telling.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How junk bonds are becoming, junkier. Next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
R. Kelly remains one of the most successful R&B artists in history, but for how much longer? A new documentary has renewed more than just interest into claims that he abused women. New criminal investigations are underway, protesters have taken to the streets, and artists have publicly apologized for working with him. Surviving R. Kelly, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. We're talking about the new anti-bullying play, Chalk, that Babs Lab is putting on at the Florida Theater. It's a great way to teach your kids about how not to bully. So how can people support this effort and go see it as well, Barbara?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, if you're an educator, teacher, a parent who would like your child to be in that theater, you can go to the Florida Theater website. And you can see under events, Chalk, and we tell the whole story about the play and how you can get tickets. And you also can make a donation. The PNC Arts Alive grant was extremely generous, but we weren't totally funded, so we're still raising some money to make sure that all the production costs and artistic fees are covered. I do want to say that being able to see a play that it takes place in a school environment is super powerful. To see people speaking poetic language and demonstrating what it's like to experience verbal abuse. Because a lot of times people think of bullying as hurting and pushing people. But our words are so powerful and our kids don't know how to respond to it.
And they need the tools to learn.
They need the tools. They need to be empowered to be able to stand there and not be the victim.
Absolutely. Since the presidential election, there's new data to show that kids are more likely to report that they are being bullied at school and especially being teased because of their race or ethnicity. This is so alarming. This is one way you can combat this. Go to floridatheater.com. Buy tickets or make a donation for Chalk. It's coming up at the Florida Theater February 5th at 10 a.m. Kids are going to get to go see this. What a field trip. So Barbara Colicello, who runs Babs Lab, kudos to you. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
And finally, this hour tonight is Turntable Tuesday on the Electro Lounge. We've got a preview with the chill man himself. David Luckin is here. Good morning.
And we've got a great one tonight. Hi, Melissa. We've played everything from Hendrix to Miles to Elvis to the Beatles to a lot of classic albums. And then we mix in the new stuff. And tonight is fairly new. It's called Paradisiac. It's number one in a 3-album series. There's actually 4 sides of this album. It's nicely chill. Look at that cover. See, we can't show people on radio,
I'm looking at
it's a place you want to go.
A beach boardwalk. I'm looking at some sea oats and some ocean and a blue sky. So it looks just like our Florida beaches.
That's exactly right.
And so that's the whole idea behind Turntable Tuesday is you pull out some vinyl, you pick something, one of your deep cuts that people
exactly.
might not have heard of or know about, and you introduce them to it. It's pretty cool.
Old and new. We played a lot of new music the last few weeks. We thought we'd flash back. This actually came out in 2000, so this album's 18 years old. Here's a little Daniel Ibotson. It's the first song on the album for you to get a sample.
¶¶
Guy Bodson. So where did you get this album?
That one I bought from Europe. It is not released in America. There's a great site. I will tell everyone where I get all this great stuff. It's called Discogs, D-I-S-C-O-G-S. And if it's on vinyl, they probably have it. If it's on CD, if it's on cassette, they sell all formats. And I buy about one a week, and I just go in there and find something special, and they mail it, and I play it, and it's all good.
You know what's amazing is our 12-year-old asked for a turntable for Christmas this year. She wants to listen to all of Dad's old vinyl records in the garage.
Yeah, it'll be great.
And vinyl has really made a comeback. People of all ages want to pull out the records and play them again. It never really went away, even in our digital era. But now it's really kind of seeing a resurgence. Why do you think that is?
I think people just want to hear what their friends aren't doing. I think if your kid wants vinyl,
yeah.
All of her friends are probably listening to MP3s and CDs, and she's just, there's always that odd one. I was that one. When everyone was listening to Hendrix, I was listening to Duke Ellington and Miles. So I think some of us just don't want to stay on the mainstream, and we want to explore. And vinyl, besides all that, just has a warmer, nicer feel. And it also allows the artist or the listener to hear the album the way the artist conceived it. Not song 4 and then 1 and then 9, but an album is sequenced. The artist and the producers take a lot of time to make sure every song flows to the next one. And
right.
Side 1 ends in a way where you're happy, and you flip it over and you hear side 2. And I think a new generation is being introduced to that concept. They're not just songs. It's art. And Barbara's here. It's art.
Yeah.
Music is art.
It's a completed piece of art.
It definitely tells a story.
Yeah, right. The album is a story.
And especially concept albums. You don't want to hear just, A Little Help from My Friends without Lucy in the Sky after it. And start, your mind just, what the next song is for our generation.
Concept albums for the modern era, too. So Lemonade.
Absolutely. And artists will perform the album in its entirety now.
Yeah. So it's Turntable Tuesday tonight at 9 on our own Electro Lounge as we listen to
Paradisiac,
the whole album, right?
All but one song skipped. So I had to delete one song, but all the rest are there.
Here's a little preview. Make sure to tune into our After Hours music shows this evening and every evening on 89.9 FM. Always good to see you, David Luckin.
My pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. See you at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Giant wave comes pounding down on you. You think it's gonna crush you.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.